This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, she's calling it a solid start. Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell announced numbers of for the first week of open enrollment on the federal insurance exchange, healthcare.gov. Roughly a 500,000 customers signed up for plans. Vast improvement from that terrible first round they had.
But still, these numbers show that the newly retooled website, healthcare.gov, can handle the high traffic from residents in the 37 states across the country that are using the federal exchange.
HHS has partnered with a number of organizations across the country to help boost enrollment. They've partnered with the National Community Pharmacy Association, Westfield Shopping Centers, and other diverse groups to assist in getting the word out.
Well, that's creative, going to the shopping centers. And, of course, community health centers across the country have been working diligently, again, to enroll uninsured patients in insurance plans, including getting them enrolled in Medicaid. We're seeing significant progress in our organization and in our state, and I think that mirrors efforts at community health centers all across the country.
And there's another phenomena this time around, Margaret, more competition and more insurance companies participating in the state and federal exchanges. A quick survey of premium pricing around the country shows that prices are being held in check due to increased competition. That's all good news for consumers.
And meanwhile, officials are expecting brisk business on healthcare.gov on December 15th. That's when consumers have to sign up and pay their first month's premium if they want their coverage to begin on January 1. And open enrollment ends on February 15th. It's a short period this year, so they're expecting pretty high volume on that day as well.
From millions of newly covered Americans to numerous other health reforms, much is changing in the world of healthcare, Margaret, and one area gaining particular attention is patient safety. The Affordable Care Act has many new incentives in place to improve patient safety and patient outcomes.
Well, that is something that our guest today knows quite a bit about. Dr. Tejal Gandhi is president and CEO of the National Patient Safety Foundation, dedicated to ensuring that patients are free from harm. Dr. Gandhi shares some terrific ideas on how to reduce the causes of medical mistakes in the healthcare space.
Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org, stops by. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about public policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please find us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Google+. We love hearing from you. We'll get to our interview with Dr. Gandhi in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Business has been brisk during the second round of open enrollment on the insurance exchanges, especially the federal marketplace, healthcare.gov, which was plagued by problems first time around. The Department of Health and Human Services announces in the first week of open enrollment alone, close to 500,000 Americans signed up for coverage with little or no difficulty. The federal exchange covers customers in the 37 states who do not have their own exchanges. But plans being purchased on those exchanges may not offer the most comprehensive coverage for the more expensive specialty drugs that are more effective in treating conditions like MS and hepatitis C. Folks purchasing the lowest price plans, so-called bronze plans, will be forced to pay more out of pocket for the more expensive drugs. 50,000 lives, that's the number saved, according to the Agency for Research, Health, and Quality, since the 2010 launch of the Partnership for Patients program. The program was aimed at reducing medical harm, and in the 3 years, there's been an unprecedented drop in adverse events in the healthcare space, about 1.3 million fewer between 2010 and 2013, about a 17% drop in incidence. The focus is on avoiding costly mistakes, hospital readmissions, and decline in health for those with chronic diseases. The program is also instrumental in significant savings in critical healthcare spending, about $12 billion so far. Officials attribute the improvements to a combination of efforts, including pay-for-performance incentives, increases in public reporting of data, and the sharing of best practices. And obesity exacts a hefty toll globally, about $2 trillion in healthcare costs. America's widening girth is the target of many pilot programs aimed at reducing consumption. The FDA has approved a program that, starting in November, will require most fast food restaurant chains across the nation, including movie theaters, to list calorie counts of their food items. While there have been programs of this type in targeted areas, data are still being compiled on whether or not it actually works. Although there are a smattering of studies showing over time, consumers begin to order with more awareness of calorie intake that they were blithely ordering before. Yes, Virginia, that double-double chocolate truffle latte really is 900 calories. Might want to think about a grande black coffee instead. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Tejal Gandhi, President and CEO of the National Patient Safety Foundation and the NPSF Lucian Leap Institute, which is dedicated to creating a world where patients and those who care for them are free from harm. Dr. Gandhi is an internist and associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. She was the executive director of quality and safety at Brigham and Women's Hospital for 10 years, was also chief quality and safety officer at Partners Healthcare in Boston. She earned her master's in public health as well as her medical degree from Harvard. Dr. Gandhi, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
You know, the National Patient Safety Foundation was created in the late 1990s on a fairly simple premise that seems in sync with the intent of the Hippocratic Oath to prevent harm and improve patient safety. And yet, as we've learned from the groundbreaking 1999 IOM report to Err as Human, medical mistakes have led to an estimated 90,000 deaths per year in this country, with even higher estimates more recently. Could you give our listeners an overview of just how far we've come since the release of the IOM report, when patient safety was not even part of the national healthcare discussion?
Sure. And I think that's an accurate description, in that when the IOM report came out in 1999, most people in the public were not aware really of medical errors, but also in the health profession, we didn't really talk about medical errors, didn't really think it was a significant problem. So the IOM report really did open up a whole new field of patient safety. And since then, we have come a long way. Most, or if not all, hospitals, for example, have patient safety programs and patient safety teams and people really who are dedicated to trying to prevent medical errors. Accreditors like the Joint Commission have specific requirements around patient safety and look for that. And clinicians, nurses, doctors are being trained on patient safety, even at the medical school level, certainly at the residency level. So a lot has happened since 1999. Some of the key areas that we've seen some improvement are, for example, reducing infections, which, again, back in 1999, a lot of infections were felt to be just part of doing business mm-hmm. in healthcare, that they weren't preventable, and we've learned that they are, and there's been progress there. And also on changing culture, which we could talk about a little bit more, but really creating a culture where it's the expectation that people will talk about mistakes in order to learn from them, which is a pretty significant cultural shift, and we're now trying to measure that culture and really make sure that we're creating that kind of culture across healthcare.
Well, Dr. Gandhi, in these few short years, really, since the founding of the National Patient Safety Foundation, this organization of stakeholders has elevated patient safety to the status of a science as well as a discipline. And I know that you've created forums for sharing and dissemination of best practices from around the country and the world that have led to better patient safety in the healthcare setting. But tell us more, you know, maybe this touches on the culture issue. Who are the partners and stakeholders working with you in this shared goal of advancing patient safety? And what have you learned from some of these partners that have been able to demonstrate significant improvements in patient safety within their healthcare systems?
Well, you know, NPSF has always prided itself on really being the big tent where everyone can come to the table and work on patient safety together. And we've really realized that there's no way we're going to drive forward improvements in patient safety without having everyone at the table. So when I say everyone, I mean patients, first and foremost, but healthcare organizations, clinicians, regulators and government, and also people from industry, vendors who are creating new technologies, for example, that are hopefully going to try to prevent errors through some of those technologies. And so having all of those people at the table is really critical to advancing the movement. Some key lessons learned, as you asked about, is First is that culture of safety. We will not make progress on safety if people are afraid to talk about errors. And so leading systems have really created cultures where it's the expectation of everyone in the organization to learn from errors, to improve based on things that have happened, to include patients in those learning discussions, and make sure that changes are made that are not just, oh, we'll just educate the nurse to not do that again, but really systematic changes that hopefully will prevent that error going forward. And I think that's the second real lesson learned, is that we need to have robust systems to learn from errors. There's no point in reporting an error if an organization isn't set up to really learn and improve based on that error. And we have started to take learnings from other industries like aviation and nuclear power, and again, to design systems with ways to prevent error, as opposed to just asking clinicians to work harder and be more careful, which we know will never get us to the high reliability healthcare system that we want. And then the last lesson learned is the fact that we have to have a real focus on patient engagement and having partnerships with patients to create safer care. The Lucian Leap Institute, that is the NPSF think tank, put out a report on this just in the last year about how critical it is to partner with patients to improve care. And that's at multiple levels. It's not only at the sharp end where patients are receiving care, though that's clearly critical. And what that looks like is shared decision-making, really making sure patients understand what their options are and that the plan is being created with the patient as a complete partner, but also having patients sit on hospital committees and quality improvement activities and patients on boards of hospitals and health systems and so on, to make sure that patient voice is really heard throughout the organization.
You know, I was thinking as you were talking there about one of our guests who was on, Dr. Provenost. He was telling us the story about, you were talking about change of culture, about talking to the cardiology group and how everybody in the team has to be able, the sort of the Toyota experience, I got to be able to stop the assembly line going, and just sort of the proposition that the nurse could tell one of the leading cardiologists in the world that they're making a mistake was
go back and wash your hands
was going to be a culture change. So really, it took to heart some of the thoughts that you just shared with us. But let's drill down a little on the impact on patient safety, and particularly around hospital-acquired infections. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention recently released a report featuring stats on the reduction of hospital infections, and the National and State Healthcare Associated of Infection Progress report is compiled with data submitted by more than 12,000 acute care hospitals across the nation addressing infection rates. And there's been some really good news there, at least in a certain kind of hospital-acquired infections. Could you tell us more about those results?
Well, we've definitely made progress according to recent CDC estimates on infections such as bloodstream infections. And, you know, there's other types of infections in hospitals as well that the CDC tracks, such as catheter-associated urinary tract infections and ventilator-associated pneumonias and so on. In the past, it was felt that these were not preventable types of infections, and just, you know, being in the hospital, these infections happen. And so that shift in mindset that these are preventable has been huge, as well as really creating better best practices to say, well, how do we prevent them? And that, you know, you mentioned Dr. Provenost and his work around central line infection has been really critical to showing the way for how hospitals, and particularly intensive care units, can reduce rates of these kinds of infections. I think the other reasons for why we've made progress on infections, one, the CDC is actually measuring them. We've had a real struggle in patient safety to measure errors, but in infections, we can measure infections. And so just having that measurement present is a driver for improvement. And then other key drivers have been the fact that accreditors, such as the Joint Commission, look for certain activities related to infection prevention. And also there's financial penalties tied to having high infection rates through Medicare. And so I think this confluence of factors is certainly the reason for why we've made progress on infections.
Well, Dr. Gandhi, the area of infection control is certainly one where we've seen such great progress. Another area that we've seen some dramatic improvements is in the whole area of medication safety, reduction in prescribing errors, and the whole area of adverse drug events. And it occurs to me, when we think about the patient safety movement, if we think of 1999 as kind of a ground zero year, the movement really also coincides with the development and the implementation and finally the widespread use of electronic health records and electronic prescribing systems, and yet we still have too many adverse drug events. What's been the most successful, based on your research, in reducing adverse drug events beyond e-prescribing? And what kinds of new system supports have improved our ability to prescribe medicine and get the best effectiveness with the highest safety?
Well, it's a great question. And I think your point about the confluence of electronic health records with the IOM report is a good one, in that it really has brought potential for how we can improve systems in healthcare by having things more electronic with better technology, et cetera. And computerized physician order entry, which is basically electronic prescribing in hospitals, and electronic prescribing systems in the outpatient setting, have made substantial reductions in those prescribing errors. You also mentioned drug interactions, and these electronic systems have the potential to prevent errors, but they have to be used in an optimal way. And so we still may not be getting the full benefit of even those kinds of systems if, for example, we are alerting clinicians about every drug interaction that exists. Because it comes to the point where there are so many alerts that people just end up starting to ignore them because they can't get their work done because there's so many alerts. And there's been a real science around alert fatigue that has started to emerge that says we can't alert on every single thing and we need to prioritize. So even some of these systems that we think we've made progress in, which we have around reducing prescribing errors, there's ways to optimize that we still have to work on to try to make sure we get the full benefit. But, you know, even if we prevent prescribing errors, there's lots of other ways that medication errors can happen and subsequently leading to preventable adverse drug events. And so there could be pharmacy dispensing errors. There could be errors in administration, and that could be in a hospital with a nurse giving the medication at the bedside. That could be in the home where the patient is taking the medication. There has been progress in pharmacies, for example. There's much better electronic dispensing systems, even the use of robots, for example, to help reduce dispensing errors. And then at the bedside in hospitals, there's been really good evidence that barcode systems, so basically the nurse having, you know, an electronic list of all the medications that are due and then being able to match that with barcode technology at the bedside to make sure it's the right patient, the right drug, the right dose, the right time, those systems have really shown significant reductions in those administration errors. So lots of different technologies that have demonstrated value in the medication process.
We're speaking today with Dr. Tejal Gandhi, president of the National Patient Safety Foundation and the NPSF Lucian Leap Institute, which are dedicated to transforming healthcare systems to better improve patient safety. Dr. Gandhi is an internist and associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. She was the executive director of quality and safety at Brigham and Women's Hospital for 10 years. Dr. Gandhi, you've been in the trenches of patient safety for some time now, and the Affordable Care Act has numerous provisions in place intended to foster improved patient safety and better health outcomes by incentivizing system transformation. And the Department of Health and Human Services has launched a $1 billion campaign called the Partnership for Patients to work towards reducing patient harm. How are these policy directives and government initiatives enhancing the work that you're doing at the foundation?
Well, they're absolutely enhancing the work we do at the foundation by having increased focus for hospitals and health systems on trying to improve patient safety. The Partnership for Patients, and particularly the hospital engagement networks that were set up, have created collaborative networks of organizations that are working together to share best practices and improve patient safety. And these, you know, networks of hospitals and health systems have been trying to reduce infections and reduce readmissions and so on. So they've really created ways for organizations to share with each other and learn from each other, which I think is really how we're going to move forward in patient safety. Is we can't all be working in silos, and we need to really be transparent and sharing to make sure that every organization moves forward. The other way that the Partnership for Patients has worked with NPSS is that we, for example, put out the white paper in the last year about partnering with patients for safe care, and they helped promote that across these collaborative organizations by having a webinar and making sure their constituents were seeing the work of NPSF. So, you know, we hope to continue to partner with groups like that to really spread the knowledge that we have at NPSF.
Dr. Gandhi, the National Patient Safety Foundation has led the effort to create a new medical specialty in patient safety by developing a certification system, which I would be interested in hearing more about. Is this a board-level certification in addition to one's primary specialty area? Is it exclusive to physicians, or are other health professions also developing certification in this area? Tell us more about that.
Sure. So MPSF has created a certification program for any type of person in healthcare who is doing work in patient safety. So it's not limited to physicians or nurses or a certain type of healthcare professional. This is not a board-level certification for physicians like a physician would be a board-certified cardiologist, for example. It's a little bit different, but it is called that you become a certified professional in patient safety, a CPPS, and it's also different from a certificate program. So a certificate means you've taken a course and you get a certificate. Our certification means that you have a certain level of competency in patient safety, and you have to demonstrate that by initially going and taking an exam at a testing center. And it's really intended for people who have been in the trenches, as you described it, people who have been in the trenches doing patient safety work for several years. It's not meant for someone who's taken a course and now wants to go take this exam. You really need to have practical experience on the ground in doing this kind of work. And the idea is that by taking the exam and passing it and becoming a certified professional in patient safety, we are trying to demonstrate that to be in the field of patient safety, there are certain core competencies that people need to have, basically trying to elevate patient safety as a field. I thought this was very helpful, in thinking about when I used to run a quality and safety program at Brigham and Women's. We used to be trying to hire people to work in our quality and safety department. And so if somebody had this kind of credential when they're interviewing, it just demonstrates again that this person really has a high level of competency compared to somebody who does not have the credential, and then you're trying to figure out, well, how much do they really know about patient safety? So I would envision over time, the certification's a relatively early program. We've got between 600 and 700 people that have gone through and become certified and are fully expecting that number to continue to grow, and I would expect that this would be the kind of credential that every organization around the country should have someone with this kind of credential in their safety department. The other interesting thing is we've had a lot of interest internationally for this credential as well, as people are trying to, again, develop these competencies in other countries which maybe haven't been working on safety as long as we have in the U.S. and are trying to build up that skill set in their countries.
You know, Dr. Gandhi, tell us a little more about the National Patient Safety Foundation and the Lucian Leap Institute. Where are you all located? What's the size? Who are some of your strategic partners? And what's next on your agenda in terms of objectives you have?
Sure. So the National Patient Safety Foundation has been around since 1997. We're currently based in Boston, Massachusetts. We are a relatively small foundation, have about 18 people, but have really had a national reach since that 1997, and we're the first organization to have a sole focus on patient safety. As I mentioned, we partner with everyone from accreditors and government agencies to industry and vendors to healthcare systems. We have hospital members of NPSF. We have individual members of NPSF, over 2,000 people who are individual members that are folks working in the trenches on patient safety. And so that is kind of our constituency of people that we work with. We have a lot of activities planned. The NPSF Lucian Leap Institute is kind of our North Star that tells us what activities we need to focus on. And so the five areas that the NPSF Lucian Leap Institute has been focusing on for the last 8 years or so are transforming medical education to include more quality and safety work, care integration, making sure that care is really coordinated across the continuum of care, worker safety, we call it joy and meaning at work, which is an interesting area because we focus so much on patient safety, which we really obviously need to do. Mm-hmm. But the concept here is that if the people working in healthcare are not safe or are having physical and psychological harm themselves, it will be very hard for them to deliver safe care to patients. And we know from statistics that healthcare is actually one of the least safe industries out there. So we have decided that worker safety is really a precondition to patient safety and to have some activities in that space. The fourth area is patient engagement, which I've already talked about, and really promoting best practices there. And the last is transparency. And again, this idea of we can't be working in silos, but we need to make sure that we're sharing best practices more broadly to make sure that everyone is learning and improving.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Tejal Gandhi, president of the National Patient Safety Foundation and the Lucian Leap Institute, which is dedicated to creating a world where patients and those who care for them are free from harm. You can learn more about her work by going to www.npsf.org. Dr. Gandhi, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, the Urban Institute is out with a new report that looks at how the Affordable Care Act has affected the number of uninsured. Its survey data showed that the number of uninsured adults dropped by 8 million between September and June. The open enrollment period for the ACA marketplaces began October 1st. The percentage of uninsured in the United States was an estimated 13.9% in June, compared with 17.9% in September, the survey found. The drop in the percentage of uninsured was more pronounced in states that expanded Medicaid under the ACA. In those states, the rate of uninsured was 10.1% in June, a 6 percentage point drop from September. Meanwhile, the states that haven't expanded Medicaid, there are currently 24 of them, have an uninsured rate of 18.3%, down slightly from a 20% rate in September. These are, of course, only estimates from a survey taken a few months after the first open enrollment period under the healthcare law. The data don't include a breakdown of the sources of insurance for the previously uninsured. They do, however, show that the insurance gains overwhelmingly occurred in families whose incomes were below 400% of the federal poverty level. That's $95,400 for a family of four this year, making those families eligible for subsidies on the insurance marketplaces or Medicaid coverage. The survey, which has been taken quarterly since 2013, is funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Urban Institute. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. In the emergency room or the ICU, clinicians are confronted with a myriad of unpredictable medical crises that sometimes can be challenging to diagnose. Most of these clinicians are now communicating with colleagues via their smartphones, often sending images of a patient's unique symptoms or chest x-rays to one another for shared diagnosis. ICU physician Dr. Josh Landy was noticing a growing trend of image sharing via smartphones to crowdsource second opinions from friends and colleagues across the country. But he also was concerned about the potential violation of HIPAA regulations. So he developed an app for that. He created Figure One, a sort of Instagram for doctors in which images can be de-identified but shared across a dedicated social media platform that would allow input from clinicians within their network. Doctors are using the app to communicate not only with colleagues within their hospital settings, but around the world where someone might have superior expertise with a certain condition. The app was recently used to share a chest image of one of the patients who presented with the Mideastern virus MERS. Dr. Landy says the apps get about 500,000 image views a day, with about 80 million total views so far. He sees the potential for this platform only growing as more young digital natives enter the medical workforce. Figure One is a free download. through Apple App Stores and Google Play, a free downloadable app offering secure HIPAA-compliant image sharing among clinicians around the world, tapping the collective expert instantly. Now that is a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.